This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Good morning, everybody. How are you today? It's a rainy, cold Sunday. I guess fall is truly here. Thanks to those on Richmond's 103.1 for listening in. And Blue Ridge Graphics providing support to WNRN. You can find them at Mead Avenue and East High Street in Charlottesville, providing custom T-shirts and sportswear, plus promotional items for schools, organizations, and businesses. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 434-296-9746, and online, brgtshirts.com. Our guest today will be talking about education. That always seems to get everybody fired up. Education. Our guest, Dr. Robert Pianta. Bob, how are you?
Good, Rick. Thanks.
Thank you for being here.
Pleasure.
And I hear you've got the sniffles, too, I can tell.
Just a little bit. It's the fall.
And that change in weather today, my dog sleeping on the bed didn't seem to help in keeping me warm last night. We will be talking about improving education, I guess, from a variety of aspects. Dr. Pianta, the dean at UVA's Curry School of Education, and if you Google Pianta and Curry School, you get this incredible number of programs that pop up. Methods being used, studies being done to try and find ways to improve education, both for teachers and students. What led you to that? I mean, because it's not just a small number of things. It doesn't seem as though you picked one method to try and do this, but there's this huge number of studies and picked up not just in Charlottesville and Curry School, but schools throughout the country.
Well, Rick, I was a teacher when I first came out of school, and spent 3 years working with middle school students just outside of Hartford. And during that time, I became quite convinced. Maybe it was my own experience or what I was observing from others in my colleagues, but how important a teacher could be in the lives of kids, and particularly the relationships that the kids were forming with teachers, with me and with my colleagues. And so, when I went off to graduate school, that's what I studied, and when I came here, that's what I've stuck with. And so I've been fortunate over the years to have a number of opportunities to work in those large national studies that have looked at relationships and interactions between teachers and kids, and to develop some things here locally that have gotten some traction in a bigger audience.
Again, this is WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. I'm Rick Moore. We're talking with Dr. Bob Pianta, Dean at UVA's Curry School of Education. We'll be getting into a variety of programs that are being used and studied to improve education, K through 12. Dr. Pianta, you've got so many studies going on that, from my research, seem to be focused on helping the teachers improve. Is that helping the students improve? Is that a byproduct, or are there other studies that I missed?
No. I think we look at the if you look at the larger literature in education, we're not the only ones. There's also a lot of people working on this to try to understand what are the inputs in education that matter the most for students learning. I mean, that's what we really all ought to be focused on. Economists focused on it. Psychologists focus on it. Teacher preparation researchers focus on it. And if you look at across all the work that's been done in addressing that question, over and over we come back to the teacher being the key leverage point for change. And so for us, the focus for our work has been what are the kinds of supports and enabling mechanisms that help teachers be most effective with students in classrooms, with the very intentional aim of fostering students' learning and development across a wide variety of areas. So the work we do, and again, I would bring many of my colleagues here and across the country into this, the work we do is not just aimed at trying to improve a set of test scores albeit those are very important, but actually to focus on the kinds of things that teachers do to enable children's, you know, motivation, things like citizenship and involvement in the school, leadership, social development, the relationships they form with one another, you know, to really look at the whole child. But to do that, we look at what it is that the teacher does day to day with children in the classrooms that they work in that produce those kind of outcomes for kids.
Do you think it's easier to improve the teacher rather than the student?
Oh,
or can you improve the student and that helps the teacher? Or, you know, how does that relationship work in terms of improvement?
Yeah, that's a real interesting question. So if, you know, one take on that question might be that, you know, if we had a better set of machinery in the classroom, so things like curriculum, technology, you know, the array of materials and resources that are often the focus of investments in education. We have more of that stuff in the classroom, and students would access those materials, and they'd access opportunities to learn through those materials, and they'd get better. So that's one way to look at it. Another way to look at it is to say that teachers, you know, are enablers of kids' engagement with technology and with curriculum. It's a teacher who actually delivers the curriculum. So when we look at this question, we've looked at this mostly in the early grades. But when we look at the question, we see that you only get so far trying to directly invest in things that kids are going to access directly, like curriculum, like technology. Those things will move the needle, but they're not going to move the needle as much as the needle will move for kids when those materials and those kind of direct inputs to kids are nestled in, you know, a set of interactions with a teacher that motivate kids, help them understand the relevance of what those materials bring to them.
Our guest today, Dr. Bob Pianta, Dean at UVA's Curry School, talking about ways to improve education, as we seem to be specifically focused on K through 12. How does it work in terms of... Where does the parent become involved in this, or is the parent involved? Because what I see is there's the two-way relationship. There's the student-teacher. But in some things, if not all things, there's the circular relationship of student-teacher-parent. Do any of the studies involve that? Have you found that to be a necessity or something that even gets in the way sometimes?
Yeah, it's an interesting point. We you know, the work we've done has really tried to focus solely on the teacher. You know, in some sense, this is complicated enough. So we feel like if we can get some proven effective models to help teachers, then we've really been successful in that regard. But you raise a really good point. So this, how is it that parents factor into the experiences that a child has with a teacher day to day? And you know, there's a lot of work that's been done on that. And by and large, parents are involved. Parents' involvement with their kids' education is extraordinarily important. They need to know what's going on within the classroom. They need to know the kinds of experiences that their child has, and they need to have a relationship with the teacher that enables the teacher to be effective in bringing those resources that are in the classroom to their child. So in effect, you don't deal directly with the parent. We don't deal directly with the parent as an input to the child, as a teacher of the child. But we try to deal with ways that communicate to parents the approaches that teachers are using in the classroom, so that the parents can understand it and be supportive of the teacher's efforts. That's extraordinarily important.
But how do you? One of the questions that we talk about improving education here with our guest, Dr. Pianta from UVA's Curry School, where he's the dean. The focus is on, I guess, not on improving the teacher, because it's improvement of the student and the teacher, but how do you judge the improvement of the student? There's much conversation. If you go to the websites, you can go to, again, Google Pianta, P-I-A-N-T-A. You can Google Castle, C-A-S-T-L, or Class, C-L-A-S-S, a couple of the programs that have been put forth we'll talk about within the hour. There's a lot of IQ. IQ seems to be the way to determine if the student is receiving the improvement. Am I correct in that?
Well, actually, we wouldn't look at IQ specifically as an outcome of what it is that that education or the work that we do with teachers should produce. We're a little more pragmatic and functional. We want to look at things as to whether the kinds of supports that we would provide to teachers are helping kids pay attention more in classrooms, engage more appropriately with the lessons and the learning opportunities. We look at things like the children's language development if we're looking at younger kids. A construct we call self-regulation, which is really how you manage yourself in the classroom, pay attention, get along with other kids. We look at the kinds of things that the curriculum will focus on. So in younger kids, we look at literacy skills or the emerging math skills. When we do the work we do with teachers in secondary classrooms, we look at achievement outcomes that are tested by the state. So, for example, we just did a study a couple years ago where we looked at children's performance on the SOL scores as a result of the kinds of supports we were providing teachers. So IQ is really something that's way, way in the background in our studies, and we're really looking at much more focused performance outcomes that are the result of the child's direct experiences in the classrooms.
Okay, so we're talking about test scores. And again, I may have overlooked a word or a phrase that takes the emphasis off of that. But test scores, you hear that a lot when, especially when the conversation comes up about the SOLs and which schools are being certified and which are not. And teachers or those involved in the school system on a daily basis say, wait, that's not fair. We shouldn't judge the quality of the teacher or the school based on a test score. Response to that?
Yeah, this is a huge point of contention and focus across the country right now. So, the accountability movement pushes further into education, when it first started, we were looking at test scores as a way of holding schools accountable and principals accountable. Are the schools achieving what we call the annual yearly progress in terms of the movement of kids' scores up? And as that has pushed further, now we see individual teachers being held accountable or discussions about their being held accountable for the test scores on an annual basis of the children in their classroom. We call this the use of what's called value added. That is, how much does a given teacher help contribute to the growth in children's scores over a year? And this has been extraordinarily controversial when it initially started. I think people were there were discussions in Los Angeles, for example. This is oftentimes raised as one of the worst examples of the use of test scores, that that the LA Times posted the test scores of individual teachers or the kids of individual teachers in LA, and you see this reflected in the recent challenges in dealing with teacher evaluations in the Chicago public schools. Where I think we are now is a point where there's an attempt, I think, to try to take seriously the importance of teachers as contributors to student learning, and have some way of assessing those contributions that don't just sit with test scores, but that go beyond that. So this is where our work and others' work comes in terms of looking at the actual, observing teachers in classrooms and the interactions they have instructionally and elsewise with kids. So, this is a big point of contention and controversy. We saw it in the District of Columbia a couple years ago as they rolled in their teacher evaluation system. So I think we're the field now is simply trying to sort out how much focus on test scores is enough, how much focus on what teachers do in classrooms with kids is enough, and more importantly, how do we construct systems that really support teachers to be effective in the ways they would like to be effective in classrooms with kids, and not just the ways we think they ought to be effective in kids, which largely is oftentimes too focused on test scores.
11:15 here on WNRN Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call. Our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta, from UVA's Curry School of Education, where he is the dean, also participating in a large number of studies that have been going on over the last several years, and we're going to get to it in a second. But what prompted my interest was a conversation on NPR about a specific study. But Dr. Piana, how do you determine what makes a good teacher? You can use a variety of studies to aim for that goal, but what makes a good teacher?
Well, you know, there are as many different definitions of that as people, oftentimes are people's experiences or perspectives on it. So our perspective has always been that that a good teacher starts with what, you know, the definition of a good teacher starts with what a child experiences of that teacher in the classroom. What is it that I, you know, as a student in your classroom would experience from your teaching? And so our focus is really on the interactions and exchanges that go back and forth between us. The social connections we have, the ways you teach the lessons that you teach, the way you organize the classroom. And it's your behavior that ultimately as a teacher, in our work that we're focused on. And we started a long time ago. You mentioned some of these studies that involved national samples. We started a long time ago spending lots of time in classrooms observing those interactions that go back and forth between teachers and starting to take notes on them and beginning to try to detect which ones, you know, what kind of categories of interactions were there, which behaviors seemed to be the most important for engaging children in a lesson. And you know, literally over many years, we developed some models for assessing teachers' interactions with kids where we can sit in a classroom and observe in 20-minute cycles and pay attention to the features of interaction, the social and emotional ones, the ones that promote thinking and reasoning, and the ones that help organize the classroom. When we pay attention to those things, and again, we have ways of training people to do this that are very well calibrated. The observers will assign a rating, and those ratings are what we use in our research to determine effectiveness. But it all grows from an understanding of a teacher's effectiveness as being broad-based. It's not just instructional, but it involves social relationships, how kids feel in a classroom. And it's rooted in an attempt to really get at the qualities of a student's experiences of a teacher very directly.
How do you do that if you have 20, 25 different personalities within the room who possibly come from a variety of social backgrounds, from financial backgrounds, from their own genetics as to whether or not they're quiet or overly active? How do you do that for one teacher?
Yeah, so what you're describing is how tough it is to be a teacher. You've got, let's say, 25 very different kids, each of whom you should try to respond to individually, with whatever knowledge you have about them as individuals and what you know about teaching and about child development. And then you have to kind of steer them towards some goals that the educators have established for you, and maybe test scores have established for you, and maybe you have for them yourself as a caring adult. And I like to think of that activity as kind of standing in a river with all this water flowing at you from all sorts of directions and trying to navigate and steer that activity. So it's really tough. But here's the key. You know, the effective teachers do that extraordinarily well. You know, they are able to, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has likened this to being an NFL quarterback. They're able to stand in an extraordinarily complicated situation with lots of incoming, make fast decisions, oftentimes almost outside of their conscious awareness, but intentional decisions that are aimed at responding to the situation as it's presented and moving it forward in a direction. That's what the best effective teachers do. They're like symphony conductors in some sense.
11:20 on the wake-up call, speaking with our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta. He's a dean at UVA's Curry School of Education. and we're talking about methods for improving education K through 12. Phone lines, we'll make the phone lines open now if you'd like, 979-0919, and the toll-free is 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Mostly cloudy today, cooler, 100% chance of rain out there. Highs about 51, cooler in Lynchburg. Cloudy with a chance of rain tonight after midnight, lows 40. And then tomorrow, Columbus Day, again, cloudy with a 50% chance of rain tomorrow, highs in the low 50s. Right now, cloudy with some rain out there, 47 in the valley, 48 in Lynchburg, 52 in Richmond, 49 here in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And today's programming also supported by Dixon Disposal. They're family-owned and operated for 40 years. Dixon Disposal works to promote green awareness. Dixon offers all-in-one can recycling, so you won't have to spend time sorting or trying to figure out if those items are recyclable. These recyclable items won't end up in the landfill. For more information on the all-in-one can recycling, it's DixonDisposal.com or call them 978-2111. All right, back with our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta. Again, phone lines are open if you'd like to call up with your own question. We've still got a lot of material to cover here. 978-0919. 877-WNRN-ROCKS. Bob, what caught my attention, as I said earlier, was a study that NPR had covered. I heard it on the radio. Just one of those rare moments when I wasn't listening to WNRN. And it had to do with a study about teacher expectations and how teachers tend to interact differently based on the interactions they have of the student. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I think we've known for a long time, and that study actually harkened back to work that Robert Rosenthal did, many decades ago, that the expectations that teachers hold for students do play an important role, and Rosenthal had established that many years ago. We look at expectations kind of secondarily in our work and are mostly focused on, as I said before, the teacher's behavioral interactions with kids. But it's very clear, and it's been very clear to us, that the kind of expectations teachers may have for individual students, whether those expectations are based on the income background of the student or family background, ethnic background, language the children speak, or their own experiences as adults or in school, that those expectations can shape interactions in ways that that can be both helpful to the students and can sometimes constrain the opportunities to learn that might be presented to kids. So if you believe that boys aren't going to be going to be particularly effective learners, then you are not going to provide the kind of opportunities for them to learn that you might otherwise.
Why wouldn't a boy be a particularly? I mean, what is the teacher's expectation of that? You know, somebody who sits there and throws spitballs at people rather than actually paying attention to the project that's being discussed?
Yeah, well, I think the point is that these expectations come from all sorts of places. Sometimes they're teachers' own experiences, and sometimes what they read. And in fact, again, what we've learned is that the most important thing, that again could go back to what I talked about earlier. What students really experience is how a teacher responds and interacts with them. So if expectations are part of that, and they're constraining the opportunities that the children have, then you want to change those expectations. And the point in the NPR study was really, what's the best way to change expectations if they're not working for a kid or for a teacher? And the research that we've done has really pointed out the power not of sitting down and talking with a teacher about their expectations, saying, hey, look, these things are causing problems for you and your child, but actually to focus very directly on the the interactions that teachers are having with kids. And in the work that we do, what we're doing is taking videotape of the teacher's instruction and behavior in the classroom with kids, and displaying that tape to the teacher themselves in a coaching process. And again, back to the NPR point, we were demonstrating in that in the study that, that the NPR study the NPR report covered was the power of that videotape feedback about teachers' behavior for changing both their behavior for with the children and their expectations. And again, for us, it's the behavior that drives learning. And that, if expectations are going to have or matter, they matter because they matter for behavior.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Bob Pianta, a dean at UVA's Curry School. Right now, we're talking about teachers' expectations and how that may affect the learning process. Dr. Pianta, can a good expectation affect the student in a negative way? Can a negative expectation affect the student in a positive way? Can you get that?
Well, you know, ultimately what you want is for a teacher to form an impression of a child that's based upon that child, that individual child, that child's strengths, that child's capacity, not some other kind of experience or other category that child might be placed in that may in fact direct more positive or less positive behavior toward the child. You want the teacher to be responding to the child as if that child is an individual, and that the teacher's behavior is calibrated to the moment-to-moment needs and cues that child is displaying in the classroom. That's really what you want. So that's again why we tend to focus on the behavior in the classroom.
And if I remember correctly, one way you said sort of the sit down conversation wasn't the best way to do it. It was, if I remember correctly, there was videotape, and you showed the teacher their own behavior and allowed that teacher to judge what they thought. How long a process is that?
We're not the only ones, you know, doing this work, but we've been fortunate to be part of a whole group of, researchers and professionals working in teacher preparation to begin to start taking advantage of the opportunity that digital video is affording us in research and preparation of teachers. So we now have really for the first time the opportunity to capture real-time images of teachers' practices in their own classrooms, and both edit and display those images for further conversations with teachers. So we don't have to rely on my memory of what was going on in your classroom when I visited, but you and I as a teacher and coach could sit down and actually look at real-time video from your classroom. So the focus in these coaching interactions is a very systematic focus on teachers' practices in the classroom using our framework for looking at practice.
I can understand why a parent might be upset if the teacher had a negative expectation of the child. But I understand the point of each child should have their own personal interaction with the teacher. The teacher should have work with that child based on reality. But what is, if I'm a parent, why shouldn't you have a positive expectation of my child? I want you to look at them and teach them as though they can do better than they might possibly be doing, or when they do well, don't be surprised, but that's how they're supposed to do. That's what I want them to do, is to do their best and to reach higher. Why is that not okay? Or am I misinterpreting what you were saying earlier?
No. There's no question that that a teacher, teachers, parents, any adult interacting with a child, particularly professional educators, have to look at each child not only through the lens as an individual, but that view of the child has to recognize that child's potential to perform and learn more as a result of the kind of exchanges we might have as a teacher and a student. So there's no question that the teacher's expectations for their child have to be that this child is has great potential to perform at a higher level, no matter where we're starting, and that my behavior and my engagement with this child can help enable that child to move along. There's no doubt about it.
But as we're as I ask that question and you respond, two things pop to mind. One of which is, am I with the positive expectation that the teacher may have of me, which may be beyond reality, is the teacher slowing down the rest of the class, so having a negative effect on the rest of the class, or is the teacher making me so frustrated that the positive expectation actually works in a negative manner?
Well, this is why, on the overly positive expectation, this is why teachers' engagement with children has to be calibrated to what that child's presenting to them in the classroom. So, essentially what we want teachers, we use the word scaffold a lot of times to describe this. We want a teacher to have an understanding of each individual child's capacity to perform. Let's say it's a social studies lesson. And for the teacher's behavior toward the child to help scaffold, to create an opportunity to stretch that child, wherever that child's starting, stretch that child's performance and knowledge within the context of that social studies lesson. Now, you raise the other point about what about the 25 other kids? And this is where, Gladwell's right. It is like being a quarterback. You got to pay attention to 25 kids in their, capacity to engage that lesson. Not an easy job.
11:32 on WNRN's Wake Up Call as we talk with our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta, about improving education. Bob is from UVA's Curry School of Education. Bob, there are, at some point, my homework took me to this way to change expectations, a seven-step process. Am I correct? I have something down here about watch, listen, engage, experiment, meet, reach out, and reflect. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So again, I think the seven steps that you described, I don't know if that's from our work or others, but
I tend
think,
to blend my when it's all for 1 hour class, I tend to blend my studies together.
Okay.
A little math, a little science, a little social studies. It all just comes out in one big pile.
Fair enough. But I think they describe, what is a fairly sensible way to work with teachers or for teachers to work on their own, improving their own practice that involves, in some sense, we talk about this a lot of times in teacher preparation as the building the capacity to reflect on one's practice. And that is to be able to have enough opportunities to see what's going on in the classroom, understand what's going on in the classroom, have a framework for understanding whether it's working or not as I look at my practice, and then kind of step away and say, okay, is my approach here making sense or not making sense? How might I test that or experiment with my understanding and then see what I'm learning as I go? So this is a process of kind of gathering information, looking at that information, reflecting on it, going ahead and testing some hypotheses, getting feedback, and then moving that cycle forward.
A couple of these steps in the process specifically caught my attention, one of which was meet. The teacher trying some non-academic activities in the classroom so that the teacher could learn more about the students and what their specific interests were, and I guess goes back to a few minutes ago, treating each student as an individual so that you can take that information that you get and not treat them as 25 people in a classroom, but treat them as individuals.
Yeah, this is really a good point. So if you were to conduct a study of kids, survey middle schoolers or survey high schoolers and ask them what's the most important thing about your teacher, those children would talk about the qualities of feeling known by that teacher, you know, of a sense of having a relationship with that teacher. If you were to gather 1,000 adults together and you'd ask them to name the qualities of their favorite teacher growing up, they'd probably talk about a social connection in which the student or they themselves as students felt known and felt challenged. But a lot of times it's really just felt known by the teacher. And so what we're learning, and again in our work and others, what we're learning is that the motivational properties of a classroom, why kids work hard for teachers, really comes from the social connection that they have with teachers and a sense that that teacher knows them as an individual, understands them, and can meet them in very much the way you describe as an individual. So from that perspective, it's pretty important that teachers do get to know kids personally, and not just reading, you know, background information, but trying to find a way to connect with them individually throughout the day.
How does a teacher, or how have the programs discovered the best way for a teacher to listen without, because, you know, we've talked about the teacher sort of running the classroom like a quarterback. But the quarterback, and my vision of a teacher, is the teacher needs to be in control, because you have 25 different personalities, some who sit in the back very quietly and almost have to be drawn into the conversation, and others, whether it's their personality that has them sort of hyped up, or those who are trying to draw attention to themselves. But you have 25 different personalities. How does a teacher step back and listen to those without losing control?
Yeah, this is one of the great capacities that I think teachers develop professionally over a period of time with experience. This is one of the things that really the video, the use of video feedback really helps a lot, because the listening is really about observing and noticing what's going on without being caught up in the moment to moment, okay? Without the swirl without being reactive or reflexive in the swirl of activity. Again, we talk about all this incoming information that teachers have to process on a moment to moment basis, and then at the same time say, well, how do they listen, and how do they do that and observe at a little more of a distance? And it's interesting to watch what happens with teachers' experiences as we study novice teachers as they move through the career and really begin to learn the craft in the classroom. It's precisely this capacity to step back in the middle of the swirl and be able to notice what's going on in the classroom and not react to it. Again, I go back to Gladwell. That's what good quarterbacks do too. They're not caught in the moment to moment, even though they can respond to the moment to moment.
11:39 here on the Wake Up Call as we talk with our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta. He's the dean at UVA's Curry School of Education, a handful of different programs going on to try and improve education K-12. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Market Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Here's Rick on what you can find on this week's Hook.
And few songs get a crowd hyped faster than Rock and Roll Part 2, often called the Hey Song. But these crimes committed by the song's co-author have at least one UVA fan suggesting the school ditch the tune at sporting events to avoid paying revenue to a pedophile. Maybe you use hand sanitizer and take regular showers, but billions of bugs inhabit your body, and you won't believe what they do, The Hook explains. And Governor McDonnell received a clemency plea from a young man allegedly involved in the 2003 killings of a Crozet mother and son. Will new details in the interrogation convince the governor the teenager falsely confessed? The Hook, here for you year-round. And we also want to thank support from Blue Ridge Mountain Sports, presenting Both Sides of the Lens at the Jefferson Theater on Tuesday, October 16th. Acclaimed alpinist Corey Richards will share stories from his adventures, including his journey to become the first American to make a Himalayan winter ascent. For tickets, it's jeffersontheater.com. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road in Charlottesville, and they have two locations in Richmond. All right, back with our guest, Bob Pianta. Dr. Pianta, have the problems in improving education changed over time? Like something you may have done 20 years or 40 years ago be unnecessary now?
Well, I think, you know, if you track the arc of the challenges in education over the course of the last, you know, 4 or 5 decades, I think most people would argue that that the challenges are greater. There are undoubtedly greater investments and greater resources available to meet challenges. Think even of technology that's available now that wasn't available even 10 years ago. But probably the biggest challenge that education faces, and this has been consistent for a long period of time, but I think we're really going to be living it now and in the next several years, are the economic circumstances that kids grow up in. There's really no question about the level of about the fact that that poverty and economic stress is really just basically a toxin for children's development, and that's the negative effects of that start long before kids are born. Any individual kid is born, they start prenatally, and they accrue during the preschool period, and they are manifest when kids come to school, and then in some ways change the nature of the challenges that they present over the period of time. But there's no question that I think, you know, given the economic circumstances we've been under over the course of the last 5 to 6, 7 years, and the ways in which those have hit urban areas, rural areas, we're in for a tough set of challenges over the course of the next decade as all of those kids move through the education system.
Well, great, because that's one of the things, you know, we'll jump into this part of the conversation. When I was looking under CASEL, Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning, there's an emphasis on learning challenges from poverty, social, cultural isolation, lack of community resources. Tell me what prompted CASEL to get up and moving, and what has, you know, been the... how do you put an emphasis on improving education with those big challenges in front of you?
Yeah. When we started the center, and this is now, 5 or 6 years ago, we were at that point, we had some tools and models that were pretty good at capturing, as we talked earlier, the qualities of teachers' interactions with kids that were effective. And we began to get some traction on helping improve those qualities of interaction in ways that were helping kids learn better. And we felt, quite frankly, where do we want to be putting our attention as we write grants, as we try to, as we have opportunities to move this work out to the field. And we simply felt that devoting our attention around understanding the way those tools work and implementing them it was important to focus our efforts on the more challenging circumstances in education rather than the least challenging circumstances. So a good example of this is our tool for observing the qualities of interactions between teachers and kids, which we call the Classroom Assessment Scoring System. Head Start was interested in a way to help improve the quality of Head Start programs nationally, and they asked us, this is a couple years ago now, to be able to mount a training to help roll out that tool as a way of beginning to call attention to the importance of interactions and to begin to build methods for supporting interactions. And so that opportunity to work with Head Start was something that we were extraordinarily pleased to be able to take advantage of and to be able to help build the Head Start system to be a more effective system in improving children's learning. So this, you know, for us, the work we do, you know, focusing on teacher effectiveness and the qualities of their interactions with kids in the classroom and the tools we've developed, we are very, very interested in helping enable those circumstances that are most challenged to be more effective.
When you are studying something like improving teacher effectiveness with these challenges, when we talk about poverty, have you found that there are some teachers, is there some sort of link that shows that some teachers are better suited for other challenges rather than challenges of this sort?
Yeah, well, I'll be honest. I mean, we approach working with teachers in the same way we hope teachers approach working with kids. We try to take them all in, you know, all those circumstances individually, and we start with the assumption that teachers are professionals, they're motivated to get better, and they want to feel better about and more effective about their behavior with kids in classrooms. So we just finished a study with about 500 preschool teachers in the toughest urban areas across the country, Chicago, Hartford, Connecticut, some rural poor areas. And we used this model we talked about a little bit earlier, this model of coaching teachers around their behavior with kids in classrooms. And in many cases, these were teachers who felt very helpless and oftentimes hopeless about whether things could get better, whether they could feel more effective. And the coaching that we did with them, they were extraordinary participants. And, you know, we just finished a very big study that we're going to roll out in the next couple months, where we show that that coaching model is improving the quality of teachers' interactions with kids, regardless of where those teachers started, right, in terms of their behavior with kids. Everybody, on average, improved. And so to me, that really says that this whole business of teacher effectiveness, I mean, for a long time, you know, the first wave of this these efforts around fostering teacher effectiveness and using methods of assessing teachers seemed to be about firing the bottom 10%. You know, there was this, you know, discussion about that, as if you could apply the GE model to human capital development and education. And from our standpoint, the evidence is crystal clear that that given a set of supports that teachers find relevant to their aims as professionals and relevant to the context in which they work, and that those supports are real and targeted, that everybody can improve. And certainly they deserve the shot to.
But as I was told a long time ago from a former employer, you can make no matter how many people you have, if you have 100 teachers, somebody is going to be number 100 in terms of quality. Now, the goal should always be to improve the bottom 100 to as best they can be. But you're still going to have someone who qualifies as the worst, whatever your standards of scoring are.
Sure, and I think that's the case in any profession. I think the challenge here is, do we have systems, and we are a long way from this, I think, in education. This is going to be I think, a big part of the debate, the policy debate and the implementation debate at states and in the federal level over the course of the next 4 or 5 years. Unions are going to have to be involved in this, districts, state, and state leaders. But the issue is, how do you have a credible system that people buy into and can participate in that has a component that provides feedback about your performance as a professional and is linked to a set of opportunities to improve as a professional. And then that system has to be there in place first, I believe, before you then go to the question of, well, we've got 100 people and, you know, these folks are ranked at the top and these folks are ranked at the bottom. You've got to give people a shot. I think this is partly what the unions are saying. You've got to give people a credible shot to improve before you start having the discussion of who's number one and who's 100 and what are we going to do with them.
We are talking about improving education, K through 12. Specifically, much of the conversation today, improving teacher effectiveness. Our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta. You are listening to WNRN's Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Bob, you mentioned classroom assessment scoring system. And a lot of that, as some of the other topics, have included videotaping and teaching the professor, teaching the teacher, let them see their own behavior, help determine what might be an improvement. But many people would say that with knowing that you're being videoed or watched changes behavior. Well, how does that play into any of these studies?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's almost like you can never, you can never deny that possibility, because how can I prove to you that, you know, watching your behavior is different than your behavior would be different when I was watching you or not watching you.
Right,
never have the opportunity to not watch you, right, and compare it to when I'm watching you. So, you know, I think in this case, it's really just simply, the proof of the pudding is in the traction that you get from watching, you know. So in a sense, it doesn't matter if your behavior is different when I'm watching you. What matters is if through watching you, we can learn something together that helps you improve. And if we help you improve in your behavior, and that ultimately improves the learning of the kids in the classroom, what difference does it make whether your behavior might have been different if we were not watching you? Simply doesn't matter.
11:52 here on the Wake Up Call, talking about the improving teacher effectiveness with our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta. He is the dean at UVA's Curry School of Education. We're able to do this because we get support from L. Oppelman's. They are Central Virginia's complete music headquarters, continuously operated since 1890 at 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's music department, now featuring acoustic guitars, banjos, mandolins, electric guitar packages, and complete drum sets. That's L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in Lynchburg, and online loppelman.com. And I know you're not going anywhere, because at noon, my man Drew Thompson is here for Les Temps Purdue. He's got the best of 80s and 90s alternative music. Drew brings out the roots of alternative, because you can't understand where we are without first knowing where we've been. Take a trip back to the times gone by. Les Temps Purdue, only on WNRN. All right, a few minutes left with our guest, Dr. Bob Pianta. Dr. Pianta, any of these studies used in teacher salaries?
Oh, good question. The work that we've done, coaching teachers and observing teachers, has not been tied to teacher salaries. I think that's the point. You know, as we move forward, will there be ways in which, you know, our work or other investigators' work, is kind of nested in these larger systems of compensation and the like. There have been some studies that have tried to look at compensation itself as a means of improving teaching, and, you know, quite frankly, so far that hasn't those really haven't panned out in terms of showing any dramatic effects on student learning. That a couple of experiments that involved paying teachers considerably more salary, and that hasn't really worked on the improving the student achievement side of the equation. I do think there's certainly some rationale to the idea that to recruit talented people and retain them, you need to compensate them well, and you hope that compensation is tied to some reasonable measures of performance that they would have control over. And I think, again, that's going to be the big question as we go forward in this nexus of discussions between teachers' unions, reformers in districts and states that want to increase accountability and do evaluation, and how all that's going to work to improve student learning.
This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Dr. Pianta, much of the programs that we've talked about seem to not necessarily focus on only, but lean towards the elementary grades. we go K through 12, but it seems like K through 3 or even some grades beyond that. But a lot of this study does apply to the secondary schools. Are there different challenges for the secondary schools for a teacher?
Yeah, a lot of our work actually has been focused on the earlier grades, but I will say that the couple studies, in fact, the one that the NPR picked up was my colleague Joe Allen, who's also here at UVA, and I took our coaching model and took it to middle school and secondary classrooms. And a couple of the challenges that you find in middle school and secondary is really this, you know, teachers are very, very, and rightly so, focused on content. And particularly in a world in which they feel very held accountable by tests of whether students know the content that they're teaching, that in some sense, and teachers will say this to us, that, you know, I'm spending a lot of time focusing on the content and perhaps not as much time focusing on how I'm delivering it, which is often what we focus on. It's really interesting, real quickly, finding from the study when we took that coaching model to middle and secondary classrooms. It was actually around in many classrooms around here. We focused in that study on, again, the qualities of teachers' behavior with kids. How are they promoting thinking? How are they engaging them and making the classroom kind of an energetic social space? And it was through that focus that, excuse me, actually the kids' SOL scores went up as a byproduct of that. So I think what we saw in that study was really the value of interactions and relationships, even in the secondary grades. And I think it's doubly hard for teachers in those grades when the spotlight really is on content, both for them and for the kids.
I didn't jump into this a little earlier, but there's another program that's been being tested, the MTP, My Teaching Partner. What's that?
Yeah, My Teaching Partner is this coaching model that I've been describing and talking about. So it's really a way of capturing teachers' video.
So it's not another person.
When you
talk about My Teaching Partner,
it's a coach.
It's not somebody in the room.
No, it's teachers capturing a video of their lesson using a flip cam and sending it to a coach, either a local coach or someone perhaps at UVA or elsewhere. That coach edits the video, provides the teacher three clips that have feedback on the teacher's behavior in those clips, and asks for the teacher's comment on those clips after they look at them. And that cycle of coaching that, again, is we do all over the internet, repeats itself over the course of the year, and we call that My Teaching Partner coaching.
Just a minute left. What's the program? I mean, what's the next step? What's your next challenge or thing you're setting up?
Yeah, so the thing I'm really interested in now is, we have learned a lot from the coaching and other work we've done about the real value of teachers' skills in being able to really observe these moment-to-moment qualities of interaction so that we're developing some models of building training for those skills into sets of online courses that we hope to be able to particularly to launch in early childhood but in other grades as well, so we can teach teachers. We think if we can teach teachers to kind of slow down and be better labelers and observers of those moment-to-moment interactions, that that we think they're going to be able to be more effective and carry those skills into the classroom.
Will you come on in the future and talk more about it?
Sure, glad to.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Bob Pianta. He's the dean at UVA's Curry School of Education. You can go online and look up the CASEL, Center for Advanced Study of Teaching and Learning, the Classroom Assessment Scoring System, and some other methods currently being studied and used to improve teacher effectiveness to help improve education K through 12. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Next week, we'll be talking about genetically modified foods and the non-GMO project. Be here next week. Thank you.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news. On newsstands Thursday, the wake-up call is also supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.